And no one here would say otherwise. No, there are a lot of different people doing a lot of different things in this field, and so it's nice to get us together to share and communicate. This is the third workshop I have run on adaptive designs, so I sort of feel like I'm making a career of it. When I the first workshop, I guess, was like in 88, and at that time I thought that the field was very new and very important, and it was very, very, very important to create a community of people who knew each other and could support each other, as in review your papers, review your grants, you know, and you had to know enough about each other in order to be able to reference each other, so that in fact one could help the field develop. And I guess the same thing holds true today. That is, I hope that you like each other's talks and like each other's work, and that everybody's doing great work, and that the field will develop further. Now, my task here is to was one to sort of pull the field together to give an overview, and also to put the conference in perspective. And I find that those goals are sort of the same, because one of the things that Bala and Mahanti asked me to do in putting together the speakers for this conference was to get a wide variety of people coming to the field of adaptive designs from different approaches and different backgrounds. And so the diversity in the conference sort of spans the field, the diversity of the speakers. On the other hand, it sort of makes it a little bit challenging to pull it together, and that's the purpose of this overview. So let's see if I can go the right direction here. Let me just begin by reminding you all, and particularly the students, of what a conventional design is, so that we know what we're not talking about. In a conventional design, all treatments, doses, treatment combinations are fixed prior to the study. The patients typically are randomized to various treatments. And one key item is that the chance that any particular treatment will be selected for a particular patient is constant throughout the study. It does not change. And the classical example of that is you randomize half the subjects to one, strictly speaking, you'd randomize with probability one half to treatment A and probability one half to treatment B, and that would be constant throughout the whole course of the study. And then in the strictly conventional study, the sample size would be fixed. So we're, in this conference, deviating from those aspects of a conventional study. We consider subjects to be treated sequentially or in groups, and the chance that a particular subject or group will get a particular treatment changes over the course of the study. And why do we do this? Well, there's many reasons. We want to improve power, efficiency, safety, efficacy, new one that I learned of, model specification. There are many goals, and the goals, what designs are appropriate or to be considered, will have something to do with the goals. And why are we doing this now and not 30 years ago? Actually, the much early work in adaptive designs goes back to the late 40s. It's not that it's a new field in the sense of being conceptually new, but the theoretical advances that came about in the 70s, computational advances in the 70s, and then new work dealing with dependent observations as opposed to the conventional IID have given us new tools to work with in developing these designs. So this is the outline of the overview. We just talked about conventional versus adaptive designs. I'll say just a word about early stopping. We can adapt for many reasons. One is to achieve balance. So I'll say a word about that. We have some two-stage designs that people are going to present on. We have Bayesian designs. We have optimal designs. Now, there is some formalism to Bayesian designs and optimal designs that is very appealing and very attractive. But sometimes the formalism is intractable for particular problems, particularly optimal designs, and I'm sure the speakers will tell you about that. So we also have ad hoc designs. And the ad hoc designs then, one, you know, wants to know if they're any good, of course. We'll talk just briefly. I'll talk about up and down designs and urn designs, which doesn't cover them all but comes close. There's a couple other classes, and make some final comments. So early stopping used to be called sequential analysis, and I'm primarily talking about it here, again, to in terms of the overall conference, to let us to sort of point out what we're not talking about in this conference. We do not have a talk on early stopping. Now, it's confusing when you go to conferences now, because people who are doing early stopping have started to call their work adaptive designs, and they didn't used to do that. So what I'm trying to do is draw a distinction between what we're talking about in this conference and the early stopping analysis. Strictly speaking, you could call it an adaptive design, because you are, as the experiment is going on, using the information that's available to determine whether or not to stop. And the design is not totally fixed ahead of time. But there is, one could have a whole conference on stopping rules. And the goal of the early, in the classical early stopping scenario, the subjects will be randomized to treatment A or treatment B, say, with equal probability, or whatever that probability is. That probability does not change over the course of the study. The fact that you stop, stopping is a random time, but treatment allocation remains fixed. And in this workshop, we will typically be looking at changes in treatment allocation. So then, just to remind you of what an early stopping rule kind of looks like, you have subjects going out on the horizontal axis and some statistics that that you can deal with on the vertical axis, and as data accrues, you plot your statistic, and when it crosses a boundary, you declare your result to be significant or non-significant. Now, one of the areas that's really kind of open for adaptive designs is to take the early stopping rules and merge them now into the adaptive designs that exist. Because when I talk about adaptive designs, I'm thinking of designs in which the treatment allocation rules change. And we need early stopping rules for those designs too. And this is an area that sort of got my interest recently, and it's also gotten the interest of some of the people at GlaxoSmithKline. It's a very, and I've learned a lot about early stopping in this context, as well as how one might apply it in the adaptive design context. The surprising thing being that, say you're interested in a maximum likelihood estimate of something when you're finished with your study. And everyone went to school and learned that maximum likelihood estimates are asymptotically normal. So typically, there are a lot of clinical trials out there now that have early stopping rules going on, and asymptotic normality is used in the analysis of data when it's finished. However, when you use an early stopping rule and have that random stopping time as part of your study, the maximum likelihood estimates are no longer asymptotically normal. So basically, for those of you that don't know, I spent 15 years at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, and in the 80s, when early stopping rules came to be, you know, this was like the great development of the 80s as far as I was concerned, because, you know, you didn't have to treat all 300 patients before you could stop. And what I didn't appreciate until recently is that it's not that simple, that all of the analysis, or virtually all the analysis, the way I know people doing analysis, is not correct. And so it's too bad we won't hear a talk. Some of the people at GlaxoSmithKline have been studying that, and if you get a chance to hear more on that topic, do. And if you're looking for open problems, looking at inference for these dependent processes is a very wide open area. So that's a place to go to the future. Now, our first talk will be by Yung-Ping Chen on a bias claim versus an Ehrenfest urn, and he's going to look at randomness, balance, and power and the trade-off between those three things. His work takes off from an early paper of Brad Efron's in 1971, and in this line of work, it arises from the situation where maybe you're randomizing patients to two different treatments, and just by chance, you could get, you know, 90 patients on one treatment and 10 patients on another. I mean, it's not likely, but it could happen. And so the idea was, how do you force some balance while keeping the benefits of randomization? And this will be the subject that Yung-Ping tackles here, and there were a few papers between the work that Yung-Ping's done and the work that Efron's done, but not much. Yung-Ping's really gone to a whole different level with respect to looking at this idea of trading off randomness, balance, and power. I should say that our first three talks look at the outcome measure being comparing means, and the tools and the things that you think of when you want to analyze data and when you want to develop adaptive designs. If you're comparing means, they're going to be quite different from if you're comparing, say, proportions or looking at success rates or failure rates. So the first three talks are on means, and I believe all the rest of the talks will be on variety of a success failure kinds of random variables. So that sort of divides the workshop into two pieces. Now, one of the things that is curious is, where did this idea come from that we should balance our treatments? That is, at least in the clinical trial environment, there is the idea that it's really good to have half your subjects on one arm and half your subjects on another arm. Well, or at least to have your treatments with equal sample sizes. So when does balance maximize power? This happens when the groups have equal variances. And this is not typically not a bad assumption if, in fact, you're comparing means. So for the first three talks, people are comparing means, and balance is or some variation of means. Balance is a good idea in that context, assuming homogeneity of variances. Now, just to set the context for some of the rest of the talks, then let's consider comparing proportions for a moment. So we have PT for treatment and PC for control. And let's see what happens if we are going to do equal allocation. I'm going to look at three different measures of difference because the measure of difference you use makes a difference. So we have the risk difference, which is just the difference in the proportions, the log odds metric, and a log risk ratio. So for each of these, if you want to find out how does equal allocation compare to the best way that you could allocate treatments to subjects, that is, sort of the no-brainer is we're going to put half the subjects on treatment A and half the subjects on treatment B, but is that the best thing to do? So for each of these metrics, you can write down what the variance is and then evaluate the variance at the proportions of treatments equal to the proportions of controls equal to half. And then find out which, find out the proportion that you will assign to a particular treatment. What is the proportion that will make those variances a minimum? And evaluate the variances at the minimum. So you have the variances at equal allocation, and you have the variances that you'll get if you allocate optimally. And what I'm going to show you is a plot for the optimal variance divided by the variance with equal allocation. And the first plot is actually for the first two metrics here, the efficiency is identical, so I just give you one plot. It turns out that they literally have identical efficiency. And then the second graph I'll show you is for the log risk ratio. Okay, so here's the first plot. We have the proportions for treatment and control along the axes here at the bottom. And on the vertical axes, the maximum value is 1. That's total efficiency, and the minimum value is 0.5. And what you see is that actually for these two metrics, things are not bad. Equal allocation does really very well, except if you happen to fall, with one of your proportions very small and the other off a ways. But over a broad region of the possible proportions that could be, equal allocation's okay. If you're looking at risk differences, however, you get a picture like this, which is to say that if the two proportions are equal, you have optimal allocation and equal allocation are the same. However, if you deviate even the slightest bit from equal allocation, all of a sudden, your efficiency of estimation drops off exponentially. So for the log odds metric, it certainly is something you don't want to do if you're doing equal allocation. So that's just a little bit of perspective here into the problems that we get into when we get away from comparing means and assuming equal variances. When the adaptive design effort, the adaptive design effort has always had these conflicting goals. That is, you want to in case of clinical trials, you want to do something better for the patient, but you still want to learn what it is you want to learn. Now, Steve Durham, who I did a lot of work with, I use the clinical trial terminology in a lot of, because that's my background. A lot of other people will talk about the clinical trial in clinical trial terminology because they're the ones that tend to have the money that's driving more research in adaptive designs. However, adaptive designs do come up in a whole variety of other fields. And Steve Durham, for example, who collaborated with me for a long time before he retired and moved to the hills, his collaborators were all engineers. And instead of looking at does something die or live, he looked at do composite materials break or not break. So, you all are statisticians. I know that you can translate from, one problem set to another easily. And at any rate, but my background is clinical trials, so that's the language I tend to talk about. And okay, so we have this conflict between, do you want to do what's right for the patient versus you want to do what's going to get you the information you need to know for the long haul. And adaptive designs that do things like bias the probability that a person will get the better treatment next, or at least try to do that, they've been criticized for a long time. With the argument being that as soon as you get away from equal allocation, you lose power. And it's been a criticism that various people have tried to counter, and it's not been easy to counter. But what I want to do just by putting these transparencies up here is complicate the issue a little bit further by making it clear that equal allocation doesn't always optimize power, and that we've been, you know, sort of led to think that because of the influence that the classical design and normal theories had on the development of experimental design. So one can't say an adaptive design is bad just because there's not equal allocation. One has to do more than that in order to criticize things. So our second and third talks are two-stage designs. In the second talk, Tasuki Koyama is going to has a two-stage procedure in which one's going to adapt in order to get the right sample size. You know, that sample size question keeps coming up. You know, what's the right sample size? And of course, all designs are based on prior information, and your prior information is, you know, if it was any good, you wouldn't need to do the study. So he's going to look at adapting to get the right sample size, and Sabir Ghosh will look at adapting for model identification. This sort of summarizes the rest of the talks. That is, we moving away from looking at means as being the outcome variable. And when I use the word response-driven, I'm typically talking about designs that are more sequential in nature than say, for two stages. So they may still be groups, but there's a very sequential nature to them with lots of dependent variables. And does this show up, this blue? Can you see that? I took a bad... Well, there's not much of it. yeah. It was pretty on the terminal. Okay, so we have Bayesian designs, optimal designs that can be exact or approximate. I think the talks here pretty much focus on exact designs, although there is a large work on asymptotic designs. And then we have some ad hoc designs. And I think I've covered everything we're doing here. So, just to provide a little personal motivation, which I think will be reflected in most of the talks that then come after the first three, the problems that motivated me were really of sort of this one of these two. That is, either we had an increasing probability of response, in this case toxicity, so we had the probability of some variable increasing with dose, and typically here we want to estimate, you know, some quantile as a function. And the other case was where if you give too much, it's bad, and if you give too little, it's bad, and you have a probability of success, and you're looking for, you want to treat subjects around, you want to know where that optimal dose is, and you want to treat subjects in the area of the optimal dose. Whereas over here, you wanted to know a particular probability, you wanted to know the dose that gave a particular probability of toxicity, but you certainly didn't want to be treating people up where things were really bad. So, with the Bayesian designs, Andre Rogacko is going to talk about individual patient dosing, and Murad, you get that fear about whatever I say is going to be wrong. We'll talk about Bayesian methods for phase one clinical trials. And then talks 7, 8, and 9 deal with optimal design theory. And I'll is Jeff in here? Hi. Yufkin is a PhD student of Bill Rosenberger's, so this is a presentation of early results from his dissertation. Zaku Wang is our Canadian one of our Canadian speakers, and Janice Hardwick. One of the problems with optimal design is that it's very hard to do for more than trivial problems. That is, as soon as the situation gets complicated, it's still computationally pretty untractable. And so one thing that Hardwick's done is look at compromising from the optimal design and what you can do with fewer stages. And as I said before, the basic motivation for all the ad hoc designs is also that doing optimal designs is really pretty impossible for many situations. So, talk 6 deals with an EARN model, and that's Anlin Chen. This is also a dissertation in progress. And talk 12 is an up and down design. Now, I say also talks 10, 11, and 13, because I couldn't really tell from the abstract what design it was they were doing. So that's my guessing based on what I know of the authors. Now, that's another word to the speakers, that is that when some people wrote their abstracts, it was clear on rereading them again and trying to put this presentation together that people must have thought that everybody knew what they were talking about, because they neglected to say, for example, what kind of design they were doing. So hopefully in presenting to each other, everybody has plenty of time to make their presentations, and so, you know, be sure and let us know what you're doing. And for the students, for example, don't assume they know what randomized play the winner is. We can all listen through another definition. So I sort of indicated before what I thought were some of the big issues, and here we have two talks on what I consider big issues, that is estimation and inference, so problems with estimation and inference independent data. That's talks 6 and 10. These are both from Georgia, Anand and Lynn. And with respect to efficiency and power, we have 4 talks that are going to deal with issues of efficiency and power. 1 and 9 I mentioned before, and we have 11 and 13, Anastasia and Fafang. And I think Fafang's our closing talk, and one of the reasons I put him at the end was because I know that, in particular, he's been motivated by this question that this problem that I pointed out earlier, that is that adaptive designs have been criticized as, as soon as you change from equal allocation, everything's bad. And I know he's been working in this area, and I'm anxious to hear whether or not everything's as bad as, whether things... last night he came to the reception, and he said... Bill Rosenberger has no power. And I thought he was talking about his talk, you know, that none of the designs that he'd looked at had any power. He was talking the fact that Bill Rosenberger lives in Baltimore and the hurricane came through and he still didn't have any power. So I thought he was giving me the results of his talk already, and I thought, well, we can all go home. But anyway, so I'm still anxious to hear what he has to say at the end of the day. Now, I have a few more minutes, and I thought I would just take those as doing a little, to do a little background work on areas that I've worked in, because that's the areas that I know. In particular, the talk tomorrow on up and down designs, there's a whole lot of different kinds of up and down designs, and the talk is on a comparison of these, so I thought if I gave a little background material, it would sort of set the stage for that talk. So that's what I'm going to take a little bit of time here and do now. So up and down designs are basically anything that go in steps from, say, treatment K to treatment K plus 1 or down to K minus 1. You go in these steps, and they're kind of nice because they're mindless. And it's one of the reasons that even if statisticians think that they have a lot more sophisticated procedures, people out there in the field keep inventing up and down designs because, again, they're kind of mindless. We can cluster doses around an unknown target dose. These designs are easy to conceptualize, easy to implement. You don't go making big changes in your treatments. You know, you don't go from a low dose to a high dose very quickly. You don't need a parametric model. They're all non-parametric. And because they're based on random walks, you can all the exact distribution theories available. So they're not optimal, but they got a lot of things going for them. So let me just talk a minute about where you have total sequential accrual, that is, subjects come in one at a time. This is a little schematic of targeting the LD50. At the bottom, we have cyclophosphamide, and you know what we're interested in is the 50th percentile of the probability of toxicity. And Dixon and Mood came up with well, actually, I guess they didn't come up with it. Again, the people out there were doing it, and Dixon and Mood modeled it. But say you have a dose at you got a trial at dose K. If you have toxicity, you go down. You have no toxicity, you go up. So, what Steve Durham and I did was develop for this problem what is the asymptotic distribution of the treatments that would result if you did that procedure. And in fact, those green lines represent then the probability of treating. If these were the doses that you were going to use, the green bars there represent the probability of treating at each dose asymptotically. And if you see the mode, the dose with the highest treatment is as close as it can be to the target without being greater than it. And that we, in fact, proved that, in fact, for any increasing response function, that is where the probability of response increases with dose, the asymptotic treatment distribution is unimodal, and the mode, which I call mu hat, is less than one step size away from the target dose of, in this case, 50%. So once we saw that happened with Dixon and Mood's little design. Well, I won't go on to what we did later. Let me just stop here for a moment. This is actually sort of interesting. That is, Dixon and Mood did this little design in 48, right? And it's like a lot of time went by. Well, just in the last 2 years, this design, the simple little Dixon and Mood approach, has become approved by the EPA and the OECD as one of three designs that can be used for product labeling in animal studies. And they are now saying that it is their design of choice. So all of a sudden we have an adaptive design breaking into the animal toxicity group, and it's really quite amazing because this is the group that kept saying, you know, we do rats. You can't do one rat at a time. You got to do rats in batches with the cages. You know, you got a cage of rats, and they all got to be treated the same. And so they've been very, they had for a long time dismissed the idea of doing a sequential design as totally impractical. Well, then some people at DuPont tried it, and they liked it. And they found out handling one rat at a time wasn't that big of a problem, and they became salesmen, and they went out telling, you know, all the other laboratories how great this approach was. Because they get the same quality answer with much fewer rats than what they needed before, and all the animal rats people are much happier. So I just give you the website where if you're interested in sort of what they're actually doing with this, you can go look for it. And the procedure is, this is just the details of the procedure that they used, which is basically to go up and down, as we said, and they have a stopping criteria. The aspect of the procedure that I take sort of issue with is their use of maximum likelihood estimation, although it's pretty good for the LD50. The problem is, well, and this I don't expect anybody to read, but I wanted to have it on the record here. For it's got all the programs, so if you were actually someone out in the lab and you wanted to do this procedure, you can, you know, click on some of these websites, and they have little programs that'll tell you whether you should go up or down next, as if you couldn't tell whether the rat died or not. And we'll analyze the data for you when you're finished. The programs were a little buggy. I couldn't make them work that well. But they were okay. One of the big statistical concerns with the EPA was that they wanted to take the data when it's finished and use it for risk assessments and also use it for making confidence intervals. Now, if you do an up-and-down design, you cluster all your data around the LD50, you haven't got good information. It's at the rest of the curve for certainly, you know, they want to use it for endangered species. You know, what's the risk at 0.001, and, you know, it's just crazy. So one of the big points that the panel I was on, you know, was trying to make is, yeah, this is great for the LD50, but don't try to use it for these other things. You need a different design for different purpose. So in particular, if you're looking at something to do with endangered species, maybe you're interested in a very low quantile, as shown here, again, in the probability of toxicity context. This is 10%, and mu is the dose you're looking for. So one thing that Steve Durham and I did, having realized how the Dixit and Mood trial worked, was to find ways in which to modify that procedure to shift the treatment distribution around whatever quantile it was you wanted to look at. And this is one way that works. This is one way that works. There's a lot of ways that will work. But again, we just want to bias the probability that we will move up or down in order to make the shift that is needed to shift that treatment distribution where it needs to be. So if you have toxicity, you decrease the dose. If you have no toxicity, you flip a coin, so you're only going to increase the dose some of the time. And what we found out was the key was if you use the probability of heads equal to gamma over 1 minus gamma, where gamma is that percentile or quantile that you're targeting, like 0.1 over 0.9, then that's what will make it work. That's what will shift the treatment distribution. So if you get a tails, you stay put, and if you get a heads, you increase the dose. And for the same response function we were looking at before, where this treatment distribution was centered around the LD50, now it's shifted down here such that the mode is as close as you can get to the dose you're looking for without being greater than it. And so that works. And the theorems that go with that say that if you perform the procedure as described, then the treatments are unimodally distributed around the target dose. The mode is within, is as high as it can be without being greater than the target dose. And the difference between the mode and the target dose is no bigger than the interval between the doses. And so I'll just say a word about small sample sizes. And this is a busy slide, so let me just walk you through it. Over here we have trials. The number of trials come to 30. Picked 30 because that was the number that was used in the experiment that this was developed for. We have, what we're looking at here is the proportion of subjects treated at any particular dose. So along the axis here that goes from 0 to 120, we have milligrams per kilogram of cyclophosphamide. And what you see back here at trial number one is just a spike. That is, we started the treatment at 78, and the first subject was treated with that dose with probability 1. And then you start the up and down procedure, so for the second subject, there's some probability that they'll be higher, lower, or the same than that dose. And what you see then spreading out as the sample size gets bigger is the probability that you'll assign any particular subject to any particular treatment. And what you find is that 30 is pretty much asymptotic. That is, in this particular case, we started, the subject started at 78, the optimum's down here around 30. So it was a long ways away from where we wanted to be. But this distribution moved very quickly, and by 30 you have a little blip here where you started simply because you can't get rid of it. You started there. But the treatment distribution is really nicely distributed around the target dose by the time of 30. And then you can control the spread of the distribution by the changing the step size, but and that's always what people want to do, is, well, let's shrink it down to zero, in which case you have stochastic approximation. The key is that because these random walks move so quickly, you can get your answer before you really would have good information with which to change the step size. So it's like, get the information fast and then be done with it, and don't worry about trying to make the dose go, the whole distribution shrink to zero. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about this. We're out of time. The idea is how are you going to analyze the data again, and there's information on that. There's lots of other up and down designs, which are the subject, comparisons of which are the subject of talk 12. In the case for the unimodal response function, where too much is bad and too little is bad, there are up and down designs that will put the treatments, cluster the treatments around the optimal dose. And I don't have time to talk about urn designs, but we only have, as far as I know, we only have the randomized play the winner rule design presented here, and there is a batch of other urn designs that are worthwhile, I think. And so I'm wondering sort of why we're still talking about the randomized play the winner, other than it was like the first, you know, so it's there and it stays there. Okay, so back to the big issues we can think about as we're going through the day, and let's have a great conference. Thank you.